From WKAR's Studio S at Michigan State University, this is Current State.
We're a place that would say that we set the bar extraordinarily high and we always got over it.
Autos, agriculture, and tourism all are hitting on full cylinders, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
As ashamed as I am of what went on in that building, I am proud of you.
We want to focus our area and make it something that is walkable, bikeable.
We are a family farm. We live on our land.
Swinging a fly ball left field. That's the fence, and that ball is gone!
I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up today on Current State, there's been movement in the dispute between Lansing's Walnut neighborhood and Niowave over the company's pole barn. LEAP Executive Director Bob Trezise explains. Also, Democratic State House Leader Tim Grimmel on the controversial Skunk Works panel. Group member Richard McClellan defends its work. That and more right after NPR News.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Good to know this morning that the area near the Boston Marathon finish line is reopening to the general public. I guess traffic was allowed to flow all the way down Boylston Street this morning for the first time since April 15th. Delivery trucks made their way down the street, although there was still a heavy police presence. But that is moving forward in Boston. We have a really neat show for you here today. Bob Trezise of LEAP joins us in just a little bit to update the Niowave situation. Apparently that has been resolved. We'll see how the dust settled on that. MSU Wind Symphony, and what's ahead for Michigan's farmers with all of the rain? We will find out from Bob Boehm of the Michigan Farm Bureau. But first today, Democratic State Representative Tim Grimmel is serving his first full term in the Michigan House. It's also his first as leader of his party's caucus. And we've been working diligently to get Representative Grimmel on Current State, and we're happy to welcome him to the program. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to be on the show.
I'd like to, first off here, get your assessment of the so-called Skunk Works project headed by Governor Snyder's Chief Information Officer David Bean. Now, for our listeners, this is a group that was operating apparently off most people's radar, off the media's radar, until last Friday. For some months, it's been investigating how to lower public education costs with technology and through a funding process that resembles vouchers. What do you know about it, and what do you think about it?
Well, unfortunately, because the process has not been transparent and has been cloaked in secrecy, we don't know a whole lot of details about it. As the name Skunk Works implies, this stinks. The fact is that the governor has paid lots of lip service to transparency, but then has had this group meeting in secrecy without any openness or transparency at all. We know a couple of things. One is that they are proposing, quote, value schools, end quote, which seems to be an attempt to do education on the cheap for a lot less money. And I think in all likelihood, that's not only going to lower the cost of education, but it's going to lower the results and achievement of our children. The idea of voucherizing the public school system and eroding local control, local accountability, is a bad idea. And the idea that we can simply substitute computers for teachers and plop kids down in front of a computer and think that they're going to learn, I think, is very misguided. That may be good for a number of students who are self-starters. But I certainly know that when I was a kid, if you had plopped me down in front of a computer, I would have been doing everything but my work. I am very skeptical of this idea that somehow we can substitute computers for teachers for a significant number of students. I think that's very misguided.
Some critics also maintain it circumvents the Constitution. Do you agree with that? And can you help us understand that criticism?
Well, I had not previously heard that criticism, and so I'm not sure in what way they believe that it circumvents the Constitution. I know that there is a prohibition in the Constitution around giving tax dollar support to private schools. I'm not sure that this would do that. Again, it's hard to know, given that we don't know all the details because this group's been meeting in secret. Typically how it's been described is that it would voucherize the public school system, but within the context of the public school system. So without knowing more details about exactly what this secret group has in mind, it's very hard to know whether or not it would violate the Constitution's prohibition on tax dollar aid to public schools, private schools.
Just a little bit more background here. According to an article by Chad Livengood in yesterday's Detroit News, part of a white paper created by the group involves a Michigan education card, essentially a debit card, to attend a value school with the aim of an education that costs $2,000 a year less than conventional schools. So that's just a little bit more background, according to the Detroit News, Chad Livengood. Now, yesterday I spoke with a member of the Skunk Works group, Richard McClellan, who's been highly influential in GOP policy for many years. He told me he named the group and that there's nothing controversial about it or its work. Here's part of what he told me yesterday.
Mark, you have to realize the Oakland County superintendent spends couple of hundred thousand dollars a year. They've hired a lobby, a PR firm, to attack whatever school reforms are out there. So we recognize that there's nothing you can do, because we could call it, you know, some name and they would still attack. So if you guys want to make a big thing about the name, go ahead. I'm interested in whether or not we've got some ideas in Michigan to use technology to improve the quality of education and drive down the cost. That's the purpose. That's the name. And it was deliberately called Skunk Works because we were not using the education establishment on the grounds that they have a hard time looking at new ideas. And we're seeing it exactly that. They're attacking it before they've ever seen it. Their structural organization is always to get more money. We wanted more value for the money we spent.
Any response to what Mr. McClellan just said?
Well, sure. You know, it's not the name that concerns me, although it's certainly easy and fun to make fun of the name. But it's not the name itself that concerns me. It's the fact that this group has been meeting in secret that concerns me. And if the work that this group is engaged in is so important and so valuable, well, then let's have a little transparency here. Let's make sure that the public and legislators have an opportunity to be informed about this group's work. The fact that they are meeting in secret, I think, speaks to the fact that they've got something to hide. And their work has not included any educators, which is also cause for concern. Certainly the people who are actually...
You know there's no educators that are part of this group?
That's what media reports have indicated. That's
okay.
Right. That's my understanding. And assuming that's true, I think that's a huge mistake.
I want to say that somebody that was appointed by, or somebody that Superintendent Flanagan is aware of, just dropped out of the group. So it's... That's my rough understanding of the situation. One or two people apparently have dropped out of the group, and one of them, I think, affiliated with Superintendent Flanagan. I'm getting a little squishy here, though, so we should probably stick a little bit closer to the facts. But your understanding that there is no one from the education establishment that's a part of this.
That's what I have read. Now, again, it's hard to know exactly who's part of this when it's meeting in secret. But media reports, at least one or two that I've seen, have indicated that educators are not a part of this group. And if that's true, that's a cause for great concern, because when we shape education policy as a state, it's very important that we consult with those who are actually on the ground teaching kids and who are actually doing the work in local schools. There are folks who have experience. That doesn't mean they're always right about everything, but they ought to be consulted with during the decision-making process.
Clarify for us, please, if you can, have work groups, quote unquote, roughly like these, operated in the past, just more openly?
Well, I it's not unusual, obviously, to have groups that are looking at a given issue. There's nothing wrong with that. It's the secrecy and the closed nature of the group. So yes, in general, these kinds of groups have operated in a much more open way so that the public and others can give input to the group and know what they're doing. Again, I think it should be sending off alarm bells that we've got a group that's meeting in secret. What do they have to hide? What are they afraid of? And I do think that the product and the recommendations that they come up with is likely to be of questionable quality if they're not properly soliciting input from the public, from a broad array of educators and educational groups. That's the crux of my concern.
According to MERS News, your party had a really rough couple of days last week regarding budget amendments for 2014, the 2014 budget. 0-73 by their accounting, and it covers film credits, public safety. There's a long list of areas where you try to get more money in the budget for various causes and essentially failed. Most failed in party line votes in the Appropriations Committee. As I understand it, Republican Joe Haveman, the chair of Appropriations, told MERS that some number of them have merit and may continue to be discussed, but the GOP needs to see where the money is coming from. Any response to that?
Well, absolutely, I've got a response to that. I mean, just a couple things. It was much less a rough couple days for Democrats and much more a rough couple days for Michigan residents, because the amendments that we were proposing were proposed in order to protect Michigan residents and in order to make sure that we're enacting policies that are going to spread opportunity and prosperity to all of our state citizens. We have been consistently fighting to increase investments in education. That's something that is so important for our state's economic future and for individual students' opportunity. We've been consistently fighting to invest more in veterans' services. That's an area where the House Republicans are not adequately investing in. We have also called for a repeal of the Republican tax hikes on middle-class and working families that a lot of Michigan families just recently became aware of in the past several months as they were completing their 2012 income tax returns. Mm-hmm. And importantly, to Representative Hoffman's point, we came out 2 weeks ago with our budget priorities and with specific ways to pay for all of them. And so it's no secret how we've proposed to pay for them. We've proposed to do that by accepting federal money for the expansion of Medicaid, which frees up over $200 million a year in the state's general fund budget. That's something that Governor Snyder agrees with. The House Republicans have refused to accept that federal money for ideological reasons. We've proposed to pay for it by cutting the governor's slush fund that he uses to dole out corporate welfare. We've proposed to pay for it by cracking down on demonstrated and very specific incidents of fraud and waste in state government, as indicated by audit reports that have made specific recommendations about how to save taxpayer money. These are all very common sense proposals about how to save money that could then be invested in things like investing in education, providing services to veterans, and providing tax relief to Michigan's middle-class families. And yet, it's unfortunate that the House Republicans have chosen to play politics and have refused to meaningfully consider any of our suggestions.
Yesterday, you and quite a few other Democrats made clear your support for Congressman Gary Peters, a fellow Oakland County guy, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, you're both from Oakland County, for U.S. Senate. Tell me why you're getting behind Gary Peters.
Well, I've known Congressman Peters for 15 years, and I've always admired that the work that he's been doing for us in Washington, D.C. as a U.S. congressman. He is a moderate, pragmatic representative for us in Washington, D.C. He has really been focused on results, and he's been bringing results to the table. He's not a partisan guy. He tries to work across the aisle collaboratively with Democrats and Republicans alike to make sure that we're moving our state and our country forward. And I think that he would be a perfect U.S. senator. I think he'd bring the same commitment to working constructively to the U.S. Senate that he has so successfully brought to the U.S. House.
And I'd like to hear what you think regarding some Democratic names being kicked around as governor candidates. Former Congressman Mark Schauer.
I think former Congressman Mark Schauer and former Congressman Bart Stupak would both be excellent candidates for governor.
Stupak's pro-life, which some say would guarantee a primary battle, which a lot in your party would like to avoid.
Well, I happen to be pro-choice, but I don't think that there should be any single litmus test for a gubernatorial candidate. Again, I think that both former Congressman Mark Schauer and former Congressman Bart Stupak would be great gubernatorial nominees. Vicki Barnett has also talked about running for governor. She is currently a state representative serving with us in the state house. I think she'd be a great gubernatorial nominee.
There's still a real name awareness challenge with all three of those candidates, though, isn't there? There's been a lot of polling to suggest that a lot of people still don't know who Stupak and Schauer and certainly Vicki Barnett are.
Well, it's very true. Most Michigan residents don't know who any of the three of them are. The remarkable thing is that even though Michigan residents don't know who any of them are, they're in a dead heat, a statistical dead heat, literally even with Governor Snyder, which speaks to how deeply unpopular Governor Snyder is. And that really shouldn't be surprising. He has slashed education funding. He's raised taxes on Michigan's residents and families. And the reason why he claims to have done all these things is that he says doing so creates jobs. And yet here we are over 2 years into his governorship, and our unemployment rate is still nearly 9%, far higher than the national unemployment rate. The relatively small numbers of jobs that have been created as a result of the recovery of the auto industry, which has everything to do with Washington, D.C. assisting the industry and nothing to do with Governor Snyder's policies. So I would ask the governor, where are the jobs? Where are these jobs that you're promising us? They simply haven't materialized.
Being from Southeast Michigan, I have to ask you how you think Detroit is faring so far under Emergency Manager Kevin Orr, or what you make of that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's too early to say. I think all of us, Democrats and Republicans alike, want the best for the city of Detroit, and we certainly wish Kevin Orr well. I hope that he's successful in turning around the city. Obviously, it's very early in his tenure, and so it's too early to tell. The experiences of the other Michigan cities that have been under emergency managers have not generally been positive experiences. Most, if not all, of those cities are still languishing under emergency managers years after the appointment of the emergency manager. So we'll see. I hope that Mr. Orr is able to do a better job in Detroit than the track record of the other emergency managers in the state.
Okay. It's been great to talk with you. I'm glad we finally got you in here.
Great to be on the show, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Democratic State Representative Tim Grimmel of Oakland County. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. MSU's Latin is America series continues through this Saturday. The MSU Wind Symphony plays a major role tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. WKAR 90.5 Classical will be there for a live broadcast of music rooted in Venezuela, Mexico, and North America. WKAR's Peter Wharf joined MSU Director of Bands and Wind Symphony conductor Kevin Setatol in his office a few days ago to preview music by MSU's Ricardo Lorenz, Canada's Michael Colgrass, and Mexican composers Arturo Marquez and Silvestre Revueltas.
Revueltas' piece, the Senza Maya, or Senza Maya, is a chant kind of piece about when it gets right down man versus animal. It's the chanting of the snake and how ultimately man conquers the snake. It's very intriguing music. Stravinsky-esque, but that's not all it is. There was a relationship between Revueltas and Copland, and so there's sometimes we hear those sounds as well. But this is definitely this is Revueltas' sound, not somebody else's sound. The other Mexican composer is Marquez, and we're performing his famous Danzón No. 2, which has probably been made most popular by the Simón Bolívar Orchestra and Gustavo Dudamel. They're one of their signature encore pieces, and now it's become extremely popular in the United States. And this is, again, a transcription of this piece, but it works really, really well for winds because it's a wind-oriented piece anyway, and so it transcribed quite well. So the concert will be bookend by two Mexican composers, and then we have Ricardo Lorenz's piece, El Muro. Ricardo is Venezuelan, and what he's done with El Muro, or The Wall, he's taken dance rhythms from all over Latin America and incorporated them into this piece as a collage of sorts to create this wall sound. It's also a bit of a political statement having to do with Latin America and the United States and the building of the proposed wall, you know, on the border, and, you know, what that would do between the United States and Latin America, specifically Mexico. And finally, at the end, the wall comes tumbling down, if you will, or it leaves a question mark. But it's a very, very intriguing piece, and it's music that doesn't have what some might call the band sound, meaning it's not largely doubled or anything like that. It's very individual parts, and it's very unique, and I'm so glad we're able to do one of Ricardo's pieces since he's so involved in the in this whole festival. And then probably the big piece on the concert is this Michael Colgrass, The Winds of Nahual, or actually it's Nahual. We've kind of Americanized it. And this is based on the writings of Carlos Castaneda when he was a student at UCLA in anthropology and studying hallucinogenic plants. and his him going to study with a sorcerer, if you will, from northern Mexico called Don Juan Matisse. We're going to have a slide presentation that goes with it so the audience knows what's going on in the music. And on top of all that, it's a fantastic piece of music just on its own without any programmatic quality to it at all. Really intriguing music, and the students are just totally digging into it.
Kevin Sudatol conducts the MSU Wind Symphony Thursday, April 25th, as part of the Latin is America series at Michigan State University. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thanks, it was my pleasure.
Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
One of Wednesday's biggest news stories for Michigan, Ford Motor Company has broken a record for North American sales. Ford says net income rose 15% in the first quarter to $1.6 billion as record North American profits overcame weakness in Europe and South America. Revenue rose 10%, which beat Wall Street's forecast. But as best as I understand it, all the automakers appear to be really struggling in Europe. Still plenty of economic uncertainty and challenges festering in the Eurozone. You're listening to Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The head of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership says he can report progress regarding the NioWave pole barn. For months, the particle accelerator company and residents of Lansing's Walnut neighborhood have been arguing over how to improve the appearance of the structure. And LEAP Executive Director Bob Trezise updates the situation for us now. Hi, Bob.
Mark, how are you?
I'm well. What's NioWave going to do then?
Well, we've spent the last 45 days, Mark, that being LEAP, trying to see if we couldn't find a pragmatic middle ground to solve the problem. And just to remind everybody again, as you reiterated, this is people refer to it as a pole barn, but it's a building that was extended onto the NioWave building in the Walnut Street neighborhood in the city of Lansing. Very, very important company doing incredibly strategic work that is becoming known around the world, and they're hiring a lot of people, and they're really going to be a terrific company. They are a terrific company. And we have a great neighborhood, a wonderful historic neighborhood, great people, and yet we have this problem that the look of the building, as the signs say, fix the facade, is the problem. So for the last 45 days, Mark, we, myself and our team here, has done a lot of extensive surveying of the neighborhood, has negotiated directly with NioWave. And it's been a very difficult process, I must say. But we have reached, we think, a solution. And the solution is not perfect, but it's a very good solution. It dramatically improves the facade and the landscaping and everything else about the building, ranging from the roof being painted to the building being painted to a brick facade going around most of the building along the bottom of it to trees and shrubbery. And their windows, okay, they're fake windows, but they kind of break up the building a little bit, and there are other features like that that break up the building. And, you know, there was a lot of surveying done in the neighborhood, and if the choice is this or the way the building looks now, and that is the choice, Mark, in front of us now, is we have to ask everybody, what do we want? And NioWave has agreed to doing this current picture of the building, the rendering. And the vast majority of the neighborhood through this surveying has said, we'll take this solution. It's vastly better and improved than what it is.
They'll take it and they like it, or they'll take it and they don't like it. Do you know?
Well, I think that many neighbors are not going to be fully satisfied, Mark. But many of the neighbors are, the vast majority of the neighbors are satisfied enough. And NioWave has agreed, and they've gone a long way, too. I've taken it as far as I can. People, we've got a solution, and people can, you know, now have to make a decision. Actually, it'll be the city council that will have to make the decision as to whether, because we've incorporated these changes, every detail of it, into the tax abatement request. And we said that if NIWAVE does not do exactly what's supposed to be done for this solution in within 1 year of the abatement being approved, then the city council can go back and revoke the tax abatement. So there are very strong milestones put into the plan, and that's what we're working on. This is the best we can come up with. This is the solution. We think it's it's not perfect, Mark. It's definitely not perfect, but it's very good.
It
satisfies the majority of the neighbors, and NIWAVE has agreed to it. This is something that no one has been able to get done in the last 8 or 10 months, I'll remind everybody.
I'm curious, how much has NIWAVE agreed to spend on the project?
They'll spend $101,000, and then the Lansing Brownfield Revolving Loan Fund will spend $114,000. That $114,000 is not taxpayer money. Doesn't come from the general fund. In fact, it comes from developers. And we look at it as an investment in the neighborhood. It's going to profoundly improve the neighborhood because it's going to change dramatically the look of the property more positive way.
Bob, we're talking with Bob Trezise about NIWAVE and the structure at NIWAVE. I guess we should stop referring to it as a pole barn. Is that a misnomer?
I think it is, because amazing things are being done inside. I mean, a lot of prototype work is happening inside the building, and it's truly cutting-edge technology. And by the way, NIWAVE is going to hire, as part of this deal, 25 more. They're going to invest $5 million in the city in equipment, and they're going to hire 25 more people at an average salary of $60,000. So NIWAVE is putting an enormous amount of money into this. To say that NIWAVE is putting in just $101,000 is not correct.
Have you spoken with anybody on the city council or the mayor or anyone really at the city about how we avoid these kinds of situations in the future?
Well, I think the mayor and the city council and the neighborhood group has been terrific in coming together and working on an ordinance solution that would avoid this, because it should be avoided. Nobody foresaw this happening. Nobody. And, obviously we don't want to be in this place again. Economic development is critical with neighborhood development, and we want the two to go hand in hand. And we're putting the best foot forward that we can in this situation, but we want to avoid it in the future. So that is up at city council, too.
Bob Trezise is the head of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. He's been updating the NIWAVE situation in the Walnut neighborhood. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Mark. Thank you.
It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. Based out of Lansing's Let's Community Center, the Greater Lansing African American Health Institute, or GLAHI, offers a variety of programs, including smoking cessation groups, food donations, and assistance with health care needs. And here to tell us more about GLAHI's work and some of the needs in the local African American community is Executive Director Eldon Liggins. Good morning, Eldon.
Good morning.
And joining him is Dr. Don Williams. He's the Institute's board chairman and is an MSU Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us about GLAHI and the work that you do, Eldon.
Well, we just moved over to the Let's Community Center, and we've been there since October. And so what we do is we went there. We're setting up a food pantry. It's already actually set up. We do food giveaways, bread giveaways on Monday through Thursday, and then Friday we do a produce giveaway. And we work in conjunction with the Let's Community Center staff, and also with the Greater Lansing Food Bank.
Tell us about the people that you serve.
Well, they're the low-income individuals that live in the Lansing area, and we will service about 50 or 60 a week, okay? And most of the people there, we see them at the Mobile Food Pantry, which is a monthly food giveaway that was started by the city, Dr. Dunn. Joan Jackson Johnson.
Sure.
And so we work with her on a monthly basis, and a lot of our referrals come from the people from there. We also get referrals from people in the community that know we're doing it, and they come in each week.
Dr. Don Williams, tell us about your involvement with the group.
Well, I'm the chairperson of the board of directors. I've been associated with GLAHI for approximately 8 years. My interest in GLAHI has been really as a physician to work with community-based organizations to really provide the kinds of support that people who are impoverished as well as lacking good health care to provide services to them. And so I'm very happy to do that. So I'm very, very interested in both preventive, teaching people better how to handle their health care issues, as well as providing, as Eldon is saying, food and support.
What kinds of services are particularly lacking for low-income Lansing residents?
Well, you know, dental services is lacking because a lot of the residents or the individuals that we serve need, I'll say, major type work, you know, extraction, bridges, root canals, things like that. And it's hard to come by when you don't have insurance for that. They also need vision. It's hard for them to get glasses because most of the places that do the glasses are, you've got a maybe 6, 7, 9 month waiting list. So a lot of them can't get the glasses they need. And the other thing that's lacking is, you know, we work with people on the Ingham Health Plan, which is not insurance, but it's health coverage through the county. And sometimes the formulary or the drugs that they actually need because they have chronic diseases are not available through the health plan. So a lot of times they end up going to the emergency center to get what they need.
Okay.
So those are some of the issues that we run into.
The health plan generally gets a thumbs up from an awful lot of people. It's a good thing. I think not everybody has as comprehensive a plan as that, but it doesn't address everything is basically what you're saying. Okay. What are some of the more memorable encounters, Eldon, that you've had with the people you serve?
Well, going back a couple of years, there was a individual who came to one of the mobile food pantry, which is a monthly food giveaway through the city. And we signed her up for Ingham Health Plan. I think it was Health Plan B. And she ended up being diagnosed with breast cancer. So she caught it early enough so that, you know, it's in remission now. But it's those kind of things that we do, that we try to get the community to come out. I mean, even if you just go for a checkup, you know, that's going to help find out if anything that's abnormal within the person.
But not that long after she joined your became affiliated with you, she was diagnosed with the cancer.
Right, about a month later.
Wow.
About a month later.
Dr. Williams, you've started a pilot program that addresses the psychological impact of racism. Tell us more about that.
Well, over the last 20 years, the scholars in social psychology and as well as people who study the brain have really started making real connections in terms of how racism as a social construct affects us all in this country. Racism is associated with increased stress, caused diseases. It's associated with various types of illnesses, hypertension, obesity, and such as a way that people have of reducing stress. So that what we're doing now is really trying to educate people as to the mechanisms of racism and how we can better handle the stresses that racism causes, especially to the African American and other minority communities.
Eldon Liggins, tell listeners how they can become involved in the work that you do.
If anyone wants to volunteer, we have an open house coming up Friday from 6 to 8, and we're going to be signing up volunteers as well as kind of showcasing GLAHI and what we do. You can call our office at 517-492-0376 if you want to become involved in what we do. We're expanding the programs, and we really want to get the smoky sensation and some of our other programs up and running and get the people to come in because, you know, there's a lot of services available at the Les Center, probably too many to talk about now, but the main thing is if you want to get involved in our organization, just give us a call.
Eldon Liggins is the executive director of the Greater Lansing African American Health Institute, and Dr. Don Williams is their board chairman and an MSU professor emeritus of psychiatry. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. And Current State could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there doing great work. We just don't know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Its current state. Floods have ravaged Michigan this spring. The Red Cedar River has overflowed its banks here on the MSU campus, flooding the baseball, softball, and soccer complex. In Lansing, flooding forced organizers of the Lansing Marathon to change their planned route. The Grand Rapids area has been especially hard hit. You may have seen a photo that's been making the rounds, taken from inside an office building in Grand Rapids, of floodwaters rising up to the surface of a window with a fish in the picture. All the flooding is holding back the planting season for Michigan farmers as well. And joining us today to help us understand what flooding means to agriculture in the state is Bob Baim. Bob is manager of the Commodity and Marketing Department of the Michigan Farm Bureau. Nice to see you.
Yeah, good morning.
We've seen lots of photos of Grand Rapids area flooding with the Grand River a couple of feet higher than its record highs there. Where is Grand Rapids where the flooding is the worst, or are the other areas hit just as bad?
Well, I guess if your field or your basement's flooded, it's the worst there. It's localized flooding, they call it. But any of the creeks and rivers across the state have exceeded their banks, and we've got some flooding areas. Thankfully, the Great Lakes levels are at record low levels, so we're seeing these floodwaters have a place to go, and they're receding fairly quickly.
How much planting has already been done in Michigan at this point, then?
Virtually zero. And I guess, you know, we always contrast to the previous year. And last year we were dealing with drought, and we had a very high early spring last year. We were probably 4 weeks ahead of normal for planting last year. And this year we're probably 2 weeks behind normal. So virtually nothing has been planted this year where, for instance, sugar beets, one of the crops that we grow and plant earliest in the season, was virtually complete a year ago at this time, and we barely have anything in the ground.
Are we getting predictions about upcoming rainfall possibilities? And also, do you know how long it might take for the soil to dry out to the point where planting can begin?
It really depends on the soil type, whether you're talking a sandy soil that drains fairly quickly or a heavier clay soil. So we've got a lot of variety of soils in the state. What we need is warm temperatures. Seed doesn't germinate until it's around 50 degree temperature, soil temperature. So we're in the 40s right now. So anything that did get planted and there was very little is just sitting there in the ground. But We're calling for warmer temperatures. The forecast looks better, improving later in the week and on into the weekend. It'll take probably 4 to 5 days to a week in some areas before they can get on it.
I do think the seven-day forecast that I saw for the Lansing area, though, didn't have any precipitation in it starting today or tomorrow or something like that, and noticeably warmer temperatures. So for mid-Michigan, do you interpret that as that sounds like good news?
Yeah, that's the type of forecast we need.
Are there any crops easier to get in the ground under these conditions than others?
We don't grow much rice, but that would be one.
I knew there was going to be a wisecrack about rice that was in that question.
No, we need to have the soils dry out so you can get the equipment over the field. There's a lot of prep work that needs to be done before you plant as well. So fertilizer application on winter wheat, being able to get out on the field and do some minor tillage before you can plant, get some fertilizer on the ground. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. So I guess the big caution for people out on the roadway is when the weather does break, there's going to be a big push to get a lot of acreage covered in a short amount of time. Take advantage of the planting window. And so there'll be a lot of equipment on the roadways. There'll be a lot of people working late into the night with lights and so on. So be ready for that, I guess.
I did a story last summer, a drought-related story, and the impact on Michigan's corn crop. I think corn typically goes in about now or maybe a little bit later.
Right. It would be about now. And they start worrying about yield reduction if you have a planting date later into May. I don't think we're in that concern yet. But we do need the weather to break to be able to get out and get the crops planted so they have a best opportunity. The longer-term forecast, which, you know, it's tough to predict one day or 2 days out, but the 30 to 90-day forecast does call for warmer than normal temperatures, which could make up for a later planting date. So it takes about 2,700 growing degree days. That's just a measure of how much heat units there are, and we're only at about 40 or 50 right now. So we've got a long ways to go. If we can get the crops planted in the ground and have some decent summer weather, we still have a great potential.
I think everybody remembers that Michigan's fruit crop got hammered last year. But how did the dust settle on the corn crop last year? Did it really suffer?
Yeah, we had a poor corn crop, but actually the late season rains did help the crop, and we were able to salvage a pretty decent crop last year. You know, you mentioned the fruit crop, and a year ago we had the spring warm-up in March. All the buds came out, and then we returned to more normal weather in April last year and froze out most of the apples and all the cherries. This year the fruit folks have been able to sleep at night instead of out trying to protect their crop. So the crop potential looks good in the fruit industry, which is real good news for us.
How do farmers adapt from year to year when conditions are such a roller coaster ride like this?
That's really part of what the farmer does best, is trying to manage all the variables. And the weather is one thing you can't manage, but you try to do everything you can. They use tools like crop insurance to help pay in the event we do have a frost, a freeze, a drought, something that impacts their crop, so they can have some recovery. They pay for that insurance, and there's some support through the federal government as part of the Farm Bill to provide that crop insurance coverage. So they use irrigation. They use tile drainage to try to get the water off the fields as quick as possible. They use irrigation when there's Mother Nature doesn't apply the moisture at the right time. So there's a lot of things they do with plant populations, high-tech seed that can withstand some of the adverse conditions out there better than the older seed. They use a lot of high-tech equipment in terms of GPS, satellite,
I don't think a month goes by that I don't read about some technological application to agriculture.
It is really changing the landscape, isn't it?
It's
rapidly changing. And, you know, we all talk about the growing world population and the 9 billion people that are going to be inhabiting this earth, and how do we feed them with limited resources in terms of land, water, et cetera. So we've got to be able to continue to improve our productivity from the land and the water resources we have.
You alluded to the Great Lakes being at record low levels. Does that play a role in getting floodwaters to recede then?
I think it does. I mean, it helps. There's a place for this water to go, and it's really needed. We have, you know, we've talked about needing to dredge some of our harbors to be able to get ships in. We've talked about lower tonnage on ships on the Great Lakes. So any additional water we have after a drought year is really welcome. We're just wanting to turn off for a few weeks so we can get these crops planted.
There are photographs of property owners with property on the big lakes, on the Great Lakes, and they have got more beach than ever. I really feel for these people because a lot of these people are looking at properties that did not look anything at all like they look now when they bought them.
Right. Well, Mark, you and I have been around here long enough to realize and remember the times the Great Lakes levels had gone through their cycles. You know, it wasn't that long ago where we had people losing their homes due to erosion along Lake Michigan shoreline because of high water and erosion. We're in a cyclical low here, but weather events like we've had will help reverse that trend.
Bob Boehm is manager of the Commodity and Marketing Department of the Michigan Farm Bureau. We've been talking about the impact of precipitation on Michigan agriculture. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we learn about a new technology that's helping Macomb County prevent mortgage fraud. We also discuss the history of the Detroit Lions. That and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong and Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com.